This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
So,
you have some incredible images there. And although I'm about as non-visual as anyone, which is something I'll get onto, I was quite overwhelmed by them. Right at the end, when you showed a winter tree and then a brain, I was reminded of something which Nabokov said when he compared winter trees to the nervous systems of giants. Wow. Which is sort of right there.
I'll meet and match you, Nabokov for Nabokov. Nabokov says a person needs the precision of a poet and the passion of a scientist.
Nabokov also said something else. Wren is intensely visual, as you see, and perhaps I should explain when he originally came to visit me back in 79, beside his Hockney, beside his Robert Irwin book in preparation, he showed me a beautiful essay which he'd written on his grandfather, who was the eminent composer Ernst Toch. But Wren went on to say that, unfortunately, he himself had a tin ear. He couldn't tell when one note was higher than another, and he had profound amusia.
And I even am in his next book for this.
This has been a big difference between us, although it's never occluded, possibly it's partly cemented friendship. And just as Wren's book is essentially visual, I've just completed a book on music and the brain. However, there was someone else who maybe had amusia, and this is Nabokov, who said, "Music, I regret to say, affects me only as an arbitrary succession of more or less irritating sounds."
I'm not that bad. What is interesting to me, and we talked about this very early, we talked about this on The Row. Would anybody like to hear about The Row? Okay. So Oliver says to me, he lives on City Island, and he says, "Shall we go for a row?" And so we get into his rowboat, and I'm kind of like the damsel with the parasol at the head, and he's rowing. And he is rowing for like 2 hours. He does not break a sweat. We are going underneath the Throgsneck Bridge and all around, and I'm talking about my grandfather and so forth, and he says that this, by the way, is my favorite swim. It's a little bit dangerous because the speedboat people don't expect you to be swimming in these waters. Especially late at night. So in that conversation, I said to you about my grandfather, after I got over that, that although my grandfather has a truly wonderful book called The Shaping Forces in Music, which is filled with musical examples, and the shaping forces in music are harmony, counterpoint, harmony, melody, counterpoint, and form. And although I can't understand a single one of the examples, 500 of them or something, I read it and I agree with everything in it, or I can understand everything because I approach my writing in exactly those terms. That I am complete, although I don't understand what these terms mean, I will say I have to go from the major to the minor key, or that this needs more counterpoint, or maybe we should do this more as a fugue in this section here, I have all these categories. I don't know what I'm talking about, but there's something out of key, or the rhythm here is wrong. The whole notion of form as of writing and music, both being the sequential exposition across time of material in a formful way. That I have completely, and in fact, my relationship to the visual stuff is very compositional. What I cannot do, and it's what we talked about, is that if you play two notes, five notes apart from each other on the piano, I can't tell you which is higher and which is lower. I can't hear that. And so I know what if I went to hear a Schoenberg thing that I can intellectually understand, that would be interesting how he's done a reversion. I can't hear it. I don't know whether that's up or down. So afterwards, you come with me and he comes with me and we, my life is solved. But it's strange. Do you think that is neurological, doctor?
Yes. Oh, sure. But I think everything's neurological.
Everything that rises must be neurological.
Including your amazing power of proliferating associations, which sort of go in all directions. I mean, the human brain and the human mind is geared to make associations. Yeah. When nothing is fixed, everything will lead to something else. And what I think you do bring out so beautifully is how everything is consciously or unconsciously framed in terms of the past. So that consciously or unconsciously, now whether the anatomy lesson is, as you put it, hardwired into people's minds or at what level, but certainly that original Che Guevara picture is uncannily similar to the tulp, to the anatomy lesson, and that's similar to these, to the resurrection, to the crucifixions. The word which comes to me is not so much convergences as resonances.
That's the difference between us. You're musical, and I'm
resonances, and. We never perceive anything as it is. We will always perceive it in the light of our experience and our perspectives and our values, but in the light of the past. Now, Gerald Edelman, the great neurobiologist, has wrote a book called The Remembered Present, which brings out this paradox that we only have the present by virtue of the past.
He also has this notion of Darwinian, is it evolutionary, that the brain itself. You'll help me because I'm way out of my depth. I'm underneath the Throgs-Neck bridge here, but that the brain itself is a object of over across its own an individual brain's lifetime of evolutionary process, that certain things. That certain connections get more and more used and become stronger, other ones die away, that the thicket of the brain is, in some sense, a recapitulation of the thicket of evolutionary process.
Oh, absolutely. And he sees the 100 billion neurons or whatever which we have in our brain as a population which is continually being shaped by experience and itself shaping experience and which finally becomes some. Completely individualized.
You know the great line of Borges, who talks about how a man lives his whole life. A man draws pictures his whole life, and on his deathbed realizes he's drawn his own face.
Yeah, that sounds rather Kafka-like as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It's another resonance. I imagine you like Borges because he is a master of resonances and exploring resonances.
Sure, absolutely.
A book like his Inquisitions is entirely about resonances.
When my book, Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonder, came out, it was reviewed as a book of magic realist nonfiction, which I liked. This book, on the other hand, had the best review ever. Somebody said it was bong literature of the highest order. And you can relate to that.
Interestingly, there are, if someone loses their memory, if they become amnesiac, they don't just lose their memory, they lose their imagination as well. They lose their power to create scenes. They lose their power to create metaphors and to have associations. And this is, strangely, people have not really paid attention to this. They've only paid attention to the loss of memory. But if you don't have your memory, you can't do anything.
You can't tell a story.
You can't tell a story, and you can't really say anything interesting. And one might say you're confined to the present, but in a sort of way you're deprived of the present as well. Not a good thing. although, interestingly...
it's always scary when he says this. Go ahead.
Interestingly, even people who are profoundly amnesiac don't forget music. You know, one of the stories I've just written about in my book is about a musician and musicologist who has a terrible encephalitis, and his memory is so brief that if he blinks his eyes when he opens them, he doesn't recognize where he is. He has a memory of a split second or a few seconds, but he can perfectly remember music. He can conduct a choir, he can conduct an orchestra, he can improvise. I find this very reassuring that even if I become amnesiac and senile myself, which I'm expecting at any moment, I've actually been...
You're watching for this, okay.
Yeah. I've actually been expecting it since I was about 9 years old, when in one of my parents were both doctors, and there was a medical book with a picture of a wizened, bald child, and the child had progeria, which is a sort of a galloping senility. And I thought this was going to happen to me when I was 8. Anyhow, I'm 73 now, and I'm still waiting. However, even if it does
Before you go to that,
you'll still have music.
One of our friends, the great musical lexicographer Nicholas Slonimsky, who I profiled years and years ago, and Oliver remembers this, lived to be 100. I profiled him when he was 90. And one of my favorite lines, he said, "Do you realize that if Mozart had lived to be as old as me, he could have been Beethoven's teacher and the mentor of the young Wagner?" But anyway, when Nicholas Slonimsky, he was completely lucid at the age of 100. He was completely lucid at the age of 101 when his odalisks, his assistants, threw a slumber party for him, dressed in Laura Ashley nightgowns, and he told them that he was going to go to bed, but none of them should follow him because he would still in danger of siring an heir. And they told him, "In your dreams, Nicholas." Anyway, shortly after that, he had a series of mini strokes. It was almost like with every beat of his heart, he was having these little strokes, and within 2 weeks, he had no idea who he was. The only thing that survived intact and survived all the way till he died 6 months later was his vanity. He had no idea who he was, but he knew he was hot stuff. He was really pleased. He enjoyed having people pay court. He was, and I remember talking to you about this, and you said at the time that it just shows that the seed of vanity in the brain has nothing to do with what you would be vain about. Try that out on your date tonight.
You had an intriguing quote at the end from Nick Goldberg.
Right.
As to whether there's any connection between the way one's neural circuitry is and the way society is designed and the way we design things. I think these trees are sort of universals of mm-hmm. design, and interestingly, they are quite common as hallucinations. People have dendritic hallucinations, which look like trees, which look like that lucite block. I don't know whether some of you have visual migraine. I strongly recommend it, you know, provided it's not followed by a headache. But then you find many of the basic patterns you show can in fact be directly produced by the brain.
What do you think? What's going on there? Why is the visual hallucination dendritic in that way?
Well, I think you are then directly seeing some of the self-organization of your own visual neurons to form these patterns.
Is that a little bit like those floaters? Do you know what? Here's something cool. Try this out. When you're outside and you look up and there's a little thing floating around and you kind of follow them over there and so forth. You know what that is? You know, those are dead cells, microscopic cells, floating around inside the rods and cones and so forth that are dead, that are floating around inside your eye, and you are looking, it looks like microscopic things, you are looking at microscopic things.
No, the migraine is much more interesting because you are looking not at dead cells.
That was interesting, wasn't it?
No, you're looking at your own brain.
Okay.
You're looking at the living organization
of your own
cells. Are
you telling
me
that I'm looking at the actual, it's not just random, it's the actual thing that is actually the...
The particular patterns of activation in the visual cortex or in the retina show themselves as hallucinations. You're getting a direct view of your own brain.
Are there any drugs that can do this?
Sorry?
Are there any good drugs that can do this?
Oh, yeah, lots of good drugs.
Should we talk about
that? No, this is a... Kluver, who was a great physiologist who wrote about monkeys, wrote a lovely book about mescal. Mescal and mechanisms of hallucination, but with various drugs and with migraine, but also with sensory deprivation, in all sorts of circumstances, you can be given a direct view of your own neural organization, and you see exactly these patterns.
By the way, it's interesting. You were talking about how I seem to have very free associative and so forth. I think I told you last night a story. After I graduated from college, I had a family friend who was a psychologist, and he said, "What are you going to do now?" And I said, "I don't really know." He says, "Oh, great, this is perfect. I'll give you all these tests," you know. And so he took me and he had me do all these tests, you know, those personality tests. I would rather be a fireman or a fire. I would rather be all these things. And then one of them was the Rorschach test. And he said, "I'll come back in 2 weeks and we'll talk about it." And when I came back, and this is just strange, he said to me, I remember him saying that, you know, I was this and that. But the one thing that was weird was that my Rorschach test was completely off the scale in terms of association, of free association, that it was, that he had never encountered anybody like that, and that this was not necessarily a good thing.
No. It depends whether what sort of associations that there are. I mean, there can be all sorts of sort of superficial visual associations and deep associations, which are metaphors and allegories.
Right. All language is metaphorical at its base. Owen Barfield has that great book, Poetic Diction, mm-hmm. which says that language starts as metaphor, and that poetry basically just unpacks all the metaphors. The word metaphor itself, you know, every it can't help but be a proxy. This is like this other thing, the legs of a table, the, you know, whatever.
You were able to see in Awakenings and Cold Storage an allegory, if you want, of what was happening in Eastern Europe. But for me, in turn, some of the patients, some of what was happening in Awakenings was in terms of other allegories. I thought in terms of Pandora's Box or in terms of Rip Van Winkle. It seems to me that so much of what I see with patients is the stuff of legend or the stuff of myth, which I would scarcely believe except it really happens.
A Thousand and One Night's Tales.
Yeah.
I remember one of the things that was always interesting. I used to go with Oliver on his rounds sometimes, and we were driving to one of them, and he one day said to me that he thought of himself as a clinical ontologist. You know, ethics is what is the right thing to do. Aesthetics is what is beautiful. Ontology is what is being. What it depends what the definition of is. What is. And he went on to say that for him, the primary diagnostic question is, how are you? How do you be? But that opens up a story. That becomes a story.
It's the simplest, the most complex question in the world. And
can only be answered in stories at some level. Yeah. In cliches or stories, I suppose. Mm. Oh, fine. Yeah. Fine is a metaphor, too.
Although you're on the visual side and I'm on the musical side, we converge on the storytelling side. Yeah. We're both storytellers. And we both believe, as Wittgenstein once said, that a book should consist of examples. You don't have a general theory. I don't have a general theory. We don't believe in general theories. But we love making pictures, telling stories, and letting other people sort of arrive at conclusions.
It's absolutely the case with this book. I mean, I'm very emphatic about this, that with these convergences, take them as for what they're worth. You know, take them so far and then let them go. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, I have no ideology here. I'm just trying, if anything, to do for people what John Berger did for me. Just say, you know, this is, you know, these things happen all the time and they're all around us and they sometimes go somewhere. By the way, a lot of them don't. Mick Jagger and Don Knotts are spitting images of each other. And there is nothing you can do with that. But Newt Gingrich and Slobodan Milosevic are spitting images of each other. And you can do something with that. You can write an essay called Pillsbury Doughboy Messiahs, which I did. But by the way, I was going to say that my first book, the book I was working on, the Robert Irwin book, I now recognize in retrospect, the thing that drew me, almost like, you know, an alcoholic to an AA seminar, to Robert Irwin, was that Irwin's entire art is an insistence that you not free associate, that you be present to what is present in front of you. The book, that first book's title is Seeing is Forgetting the Name of the Thing One Sees. What would it be like to actually see this? To actually see, until you get to the point, you'd have to forget all kinds, you'd have to forget that I'm holding it, you'd have to forget that we're at an evening, and eventually you'd have to forget that it's a glass of water before you could see it. And at that moment, when you were completely present to something with no free association, which is very hard to get to, and his whole art is about
but,
that.
But to say it's a glass of water already depends on knowledge or associations.
But I'm trying to get past that.
I mean, you would have to sort of describe it as, I don't know, as Monet used to ask things to be described entirely in terms of color and shape and without any meaning at all.
But even that, because there's a piece that Robert Irwin has up right now, and we have to go this weekend. It's the Saturday's the last day. There's a, in New York, sorry. although they should bring it here too. But anyway, it's a piece he did right now, and it's a very weird piece. Robert Irwin has done this piece in the space across the street from the old Dia. So it's where the Torque Ellipses were, if you know that space. So it's this hangar, and you walk in, and on the floor he has put three rectangles, about that thick, 16 feet by 22 feet. One of them is painted bright chrome red, like, you know, really cherry car. One of them is painted yellow, and one of them in the far distance is painted blue. The title of the piece is Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow, and Blue Cube? There was a famous Barnett Newman painting with that title. Above them, he is hanging the identical rectangle, red, yellow, blue. Joel Meyerowitz, who went to see it the other day, sent me an email and said it was a wonderful slow burn of a piece, because it went from so what to wow. And what happens, this is really weird, you walk in and you say, so red, yellow, blue, that's kind of interesting, okay, that's fine. And then you get ready to leave, but somebody wants to stay a bit longer, and then 5 minutes later, you know, you've been in the room, you look at it again, and suddenly there's stuff going on that wasn't going on 5 minutes ago. There are things happening in the red. The red isn't red at all. The red is this riot of reflections. And you go away, and you come back, and you look again. Now there are things happening that the person over there on the far side behind the blue is reflected as if they were three stories down in a basement. And three stories, it just gets wilder and wilder and wilder. And you are absolutely convinced that it wasn't there when you first walked in. And it's as if your eyes adjust to the dark. And the reason is because when you walked in, you said to yourself, that's red, yellow, and blue. Just even the colors that Monet uses. You said, oh, that's red. Oh, that's just red. and you didn't notice, and it takes you 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes to notice that, in fact, it's not at all red. It's every other. Now, the really weird thing is that if you take a photograph of it, you can't take a photograph of it just being red. The camera captures immediately all that riot of stuff that you didn't see.
Well, everything in the mind is comparisons, and you could never see anything as it is. You're always making a comparison
to how it was.
But you in particular, because for you, everything seems to be in a sort of enormous network of similarities.
Shall we talk about Nicholas of Cusa?
Yes, why not? Yes, he's always a good person to talk about. Let's start with this polygon.
Nicholas of Cusa was late medieval, early Renaissance theologian, a number mystic. He was the Archbishop of Cologne, and he was involved in a debate with Thomas Aquinas about how to get to God. And Aquinas, in good Aristotelian fashion, was kind of inventorying everything. So, you know, if you made an inventory of absolutely everything on earth, of all creation, you would be getting closer and closer to a sense of God. And Q says, well, you know, but it's kind of like an n-sided regular polygon in a circle. Calm down. This won't be hard. This will be okay. And if n is 3, it's a triangle, a regular polygon. Now you add a side, 4, 5, 6, 7, an 8-sided polygon, a 10-sided. He said, when you get to a million-sided polygon, it's damn close to being, he didn't say damn, but it's very close to being a circle. And yet it's incredibly far away from being a circle. In fact, because a circle only has one line, and this has a million. A circle has no angles, this has a million angles. And he said, at some point you have to make the leap, he's talking to Aquinas, at some point you have to make the leap from the chord to the arc, a leap he calls the leap of faith, by the way. And that leap is as complicated at the beginning as it is at the end. And it occurs, as he says, in grace. Now, I think that's an incredible metaphor. I mean, you can have all these associations, but when you're a writer, and you talk about this in case studies, and I talk about it, if I go off to Bosnia to report, I come back with a million pieces of information and so forth, and I start trying to put them together. And it's just not quite working. Writer's block is when you've got these million things, and it's all angular, and it's not working right, and so forth. And you work and you work and you work at something.
And then you have to step aside.
You step aside, and there's almost like an alchemical process going on. My stepping aside always takes the form of playing with blocks. I literally have blocks. My daughter, when she would, remember Sarah, would come home from school and no, you can't play with those blocks. Those are daddy's blocks.
And my stepping aside is going for a swim.
And he goes for a swim. And the entire time he's swimming, I'm playing with
blocks. When you come back from the swim, somehow the polygon has become a circle.
It has become a circle. And it would not have happened without all the work that preceded it. Mm-hmm. The work is kind of preparation for receptivity, but it happens by itself. It's the weirdest thing. It's wonderful. And you know, by the way, it's become a circle because you tap it and it rings true. But
even something relatively simple like learning to ride a bicycle. You may learn that you have to do A and B and C and D and E, but you can't put them together. But one day, it's there.
Absolutely.
But if you think what you're doing riding a bicycle, then you can't ride it.
Even at the level of I reach for a glass, it is a whole action. It is not a series of process. It is not a series of instructions. Or it is an experience. It is and it isn't. Yeah. Right? Kind of?
Yeah.
This is the black hole we're about to fall into, I can feel. We're having a long conversation all night about this.
No, I think finally doing anything or making anything is beyond analysis. There is, you could say all of the elements which are there, but something else happens, so the action coheres them perfectly, coordinates them, subordinates them. Nothing is irrelevant, nothing is excessive. And you have something which is both infinitely complex and infinitely simple at the same time, and very surprising and absolutely inevitable. And as you say, that's grace.
Are you recording this? Can I use that as a blurb on my next book? Or I'll use it as a blurb in my voice in your next book. But anyway, it says 000 here, so I guess we're supposed to stop. But thank you very, very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.